Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Act II. Carve him as a dish fit for the gods. Brutus offers high-minded words as the conspirators gather and make their plans. In Act II, Scene 1, Brutus says in soliloquy that he would act only for the general good in killing Caesar, not because he bears any grudge against the man, who knows how to subordinate passion to reason. But Brutus also knows that Caesar, a mentor no less, has not yet given the offense that would justify killing him. Brutus's main argument is abstract, and it sounds like Acton's law. Absolute power would corrupt his friend, so it's necessary to extrapolate what that friend might do if given absolute power. A would-be king is a serpent who must be dealt with as such. We must, quote-unquote, think him as a serpent's egg, which, hatched, would as his kind grow mischievous and kill him in the shell. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 32 through 34. The very existence of the Republic is at stake. A political entity that was partly founded by Brutus's ancestor, Lucius Junius Brutus. Even so, it is difficult to swallow a plan to murder a man on the idea that, quote-unquote, it is the bright day that brings forth the adder. Act 2, Scene 1, Line 14. Brutus's argument, grounded in assumptions and adages, is near slippery slope status. It's similar to the rhetoric of some sci-fi police authority planning preemptive action against so-called future crime. In Brutus's time, Rome confronts a return of kings, this time in the person of a Roman. The letter, Brutus reads, written and planted by Cassius, mentions this glorious ancestry, and to adapt a line from Macbeth, it seems as if the letter only marshals Brutus the way that he was going. He is very taken with the heroic past connected to his family name. It's vital to his identity. O Rome, he declares, quote unquote, I make thee promise, if the redress will follow, thou receivest thy full petition at the hand of Brutus. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 56 through 58. All the same, participating in a conspiracy has begun to exact a toll upon Brutus. As he describes what he is experiencing, quote unquote, between the acting of a dreadful thing and the first motion, all the interim is like a phantasma or a hideous dream. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 63 through 65. Brutus goes on to compare the commotion in his spirit to the perturbations of a government and society in revolt or disarray. Quote unquote, the state of man, like to a little kingdom, suffers then the nature of an insurrection. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 67 through 69. Brutus has not been able to sleep since Cassius began his suit. When Brutus is introduced to the conspirators, he is at first taken aback by the men's disguises. Their secretive appearance sorts ill with the great patrician's bearing, or his apparently luminous imaginings of how the deed will play out. When Casca expresses a wish to, quote-unquote, swear our resolution, Brutus finds it necessary to explain how un-Roman it is to require an oath, quote-unquote. What need we any spur but our own cause to prick us to redress? Act 2, Scene 1, Line 112 and Lines 122 through 123. It's decided that the conspirators should not try to recruit Cicero, for, says Brutus, quote-unquote, he will never follow anything that other men begin. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 150 through 151. Brutus also tries to limit the bloodiness of the conspirators' intent. Decius asks if anyone besides Caesar should be cut down, and Cassius pipes up with the name Mark Antony. His logic for killing Caesar's favorite is impeccable, but Brutus will have none of it. Quote unquote, "Our course will seem too bloody," he tells Cassius. Quote unquote, "to cut the head off and then hack the limbs, like wrath in death and envy afterwards." Act 2, Scene 1, lines 162 through 164. Sparing Antony will turn out to be a mistake, but it shows Brutus's nobility. We could, if we cared to, attribute to Brutus some degree of less than high-minded strategizing when he says that Antony, quote-unquote, "can do no more than Caesar's arm when Caesar's head is off." But that would be ungenerous. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 182 through 183. Brutus seems naive throughout the scene, saying of Caesar, quote-unquote, "let's carve him as a dish fit for the gods, not hew him as a carcass fit for hounds." Act 2, Scene 1, lines 173 through 174. How is that possible? The thought sounds delusional, and, as others have noted, it seems to be drawn from the discourse and imagery surrounding deer hunting, which has long had its own rituals belonging to the precise carving up of a slain deer. Even if the act is a sacrifice and not butchery, Caesar, quote-unquote, "must bleed for it," as Brutus admits. Act 2, Scene 1, line 171. Brutus is most comfortable with philosophical abstractions, not action. The conspirators are butchers, whatever their intentions. Brutus's noble words do not betray any recognition of the impending deed's full horror. Cassius worries that Caesar, who has grown superstitious with age and isolation, might be unwilling to come to the capital. But Decius allays that fear, telling the conspirators that flattery will do the trick. Quote unquote, "when I tell him he hates flatterers, he says he does, being then most flattered. Let me work." Act 2, Scene 1, lines 207 through 209. The man of destiny has become an easy mark for those who know his flaws. Portia shows herself to be the only character who really understands Brutus, with the possible exception of Octavius, who treats him as a worthy opponent. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 233 through 302 inclusive. Portia insists that Brutus let her in on what is troubling him. Quote unquote, "Dwell I but in the suburbs of your good pleasure?" she asks, and continues, "if it be no more, Portia is Brutus's harlot, not his wife," quote unquote. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 285 through 287. In speaking to Caius Ligarius, Brutus again employs the metaphor of sickness and health. He sees himself as a physician or a surgeon, as well as a priest with respect to the body politic. Brutus is about to perform, quote unquote, "a piece of work that will make sick men whole." Act 2, Scene 1, line 327. That the action contemplated would be a profound violation of the Hippocratic Oath goes almost without saying. Yet Caesar shall go forth. Decius lures Caesar to the capital, casting aside ill omens. In Act 2, Scene 2, Calpurnia confesses her alarm with regard to the prodigies that accompany Rome's wild, stormy weather. Quote unquote, "graves have yawned and yielded up their dead," she has heard. And, quote unquote, "fierce, fiery warriors fight upon the clouds." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 18 through 19. In responding, Caesar asks grandly, quote unquote, "what can be avoided whose end is purposed by the mighty gods?" Act 2, Scene 2, lines 26 through 27. Still, Caesar partly undercuts his dignity by pompously declaring himself more dangerous than danger itself. Quote unquote, "we are two lions littered in one day," says he, quote unquote, "and I the elder and more terrible." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 46 through 47. Here, we are listening to a politician who believes his own PR. The trouble is, politicians must manage their image, not become its creature. When Calpurnia offers Caesar the cover of her own fear, he declares that he will not go to the capital today. But Decius Brutus is able to use Caesar's vanity to draw him out. Decius's opening comes when Caesar recounts Calpurnia's dream about his statue, which, quote-unquote, like a fountain with 100 spouts, did run pure blood, and many lusty Romans came smiling and did bathe their hands in it. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 77 through 79. Decius Brutus's interpretive skills work wonders for Caesar's mood. The dream, he says, quote-unquote, signifies that from you great Rome shall suck reviving blood, and that great men shall press for tinctures, stains, relics, and cognizance. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 87 through 89. Who is this Julius Caesar when all is said and done? If Shakespeare follows the line that the time has come for Rome to turn imperial, the aging, vainglorious Caesar he depicts is not the right man to wield such enormous power. But perhaps that's too simple a view. Rather, Shakespeare's representation pays tribute to the difficulty of settling on any one image of such a colossal, polarizing figure as Julius Caesar. On display are certain physical debilities, such as partial deafness and epilepsy. There are also character-based vulnerabilities, such as a tendency toward self-inflation and grandiosity, a touch of superstitiousness, and possibly, as we saw near the play's beginning, strong feelings of sadness and isolation. But counterbalancing these traits, at least in abbreviated form and by way of hints, are an impressive military career, undoubted skills as a ruler, and the sheer spectacle surrounding great Caesar's every move. The real Julius Caesar is a strange concatenation of self-promotion, the opinions swirling around him, and an unknowable number of deep, complex qualities residing within his own spirit. The mighty gods defend thee! Artemidorus bravely positions himself to warn Caesar. It's the Ides of March, 44 BCE. In Act 2, Scene 3, Artemidorus waits for Caesar to walk by him in a street procession. His letter, which Caesar will never read, lays out the dictator's extreme danger and names several conspirators. Stay not to answer me, but get thee gone. Portia strains for news of the plot's outcome, while the soothsayer lays his plan to warn Caesar. Portia has been informed about the conspiracy, and in Act 2, Scene 4, she sends a servant to check on Brutus at the capital. She also speaks at home with the soothsayer who warned Caesar back in Act 1, Scene 2, not knowing that Portia's husband is in on the assassination plot. He tells Portia that he fears the worst for Caesar, and then leaves to position himself where he might catch Caesar's attention. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Saturday, May 31st, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.